there needs to be a change in the culture. The culture has pushed far too much towards this expressive liberalism, individualism, and the pendulum needs to swing back to where the data shows us that human beings have stable mental health by and large and lead happier lives, children and adults, if they are in stable, committed and good relationships.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Michael Farmer, businessman and Conservative peer. Lord Farmer talks about the difficulties of championing family in the world of politics.
The whole area of policies to help families has been pushed aside. It's never on the political radar screen. And to get it there, one has to push quite hard, keep bringing it up, keep quoting the stats, keep showing the results in society that family breakdown has.
He also discusses prison reform and the damage liberalism has inflicted on society in the age of the internet.
I couldn't understand it. We had all these laws which said pornography was illegal. And then all of a sudden, when the internet comes along, it's available at the push of a couple of buttons. The most graphic, the most extreme, to anybody in the world.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with Michael Farmer, businessman and Conservative member of the House of Lords. Lord Farmer, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Lee.
So you've, since entering politics, family has been an issue that you've been championing. Why is family so crucial?
Well, that's a very big answer to a big question. I mean, obviously my interest in families was prior to me entering politics. It was actually the reason for me in entering politics when I first started as a donor and I met David Cameron. He said, "What's your thing?" Apparently everybody has a thing in politics, and I just said to him, "Well, my thing is families." And he said, "Oh, yeah, right, okay." He said, "Well, families, to some people, is three people who share a fridge." I think it was a sort of strap line he'd got for a speech. But there's no doubt about it that during my, well, whole life, childhood and adulthood, one had experienced oneself and one had seen in others the detrimental effect of family breakdown. And we were living in a society where the icon was becoming the single mum. So she was being put up on a pedestal. However, attached to that, she might be an icon, but there was a lot of problems. And I maintain that actually I'm sure most single mums don't want to be a single mum. They need help. They want help. Rearing children, bringing up children is a lot of hard work. And then one was becoming aware of the repercussions of a broken family. And the data on that is very strong. I mean, I've got some figures here. For an unrelated adult living in the home with a single parent, where a child is 8 times likely to be on the child protection register. Also, if you're living with an unrelated adult, you're 50 times more likely to die of an inflicted injury. I mean, those are two very, very harsh statistics. But I mean, the facts are in this country, I think 44% of children don't grow up with both parents, biological parents. 33% live in separated families. I mean, it's something which has progressed, if you like. That's the wrong word, regressed, but it's grown. Particularly, I think, since the 1960s, and we've developed a sort of culture of what I call individual liberalism, where governments and the culture has encouraged people to be yourselves. I mean, we're seeing an extreme version of it in the woke sort of area, you know, I am what I think I am. and you know the whole Me Too area, the whole area of policies to help families has been pushed aside. It's never on the political radar screen, and to get it there, one has to push quite hard, keep bringing it up, keep quoting the stats, keep showing the results in society that family breakdown has. I mean, for instance, in prisons, which I'm involved with, 25% of the prison population have been in social care. In other words, they haven't had any family. And I'm involved with the whole area of prisoners getting good visits. And around 50% of them, was my calculation, don't get visits at all. So we're living in a society where individualism, where you're living by yourself, you're living with your mobile, with the social media, is really sort of multiplied very quickly. And you've got the related mental health problems, the loneliness, the housing problems, all sorts of problems being generated from that. Whereas the positives that come from the good old-fashioned family of two biological parents committed, there's a big deal of difference in the stats from a couple who are married to a couple who are just partnering on the effect on children. But there's no doubt about it that for children, and I think for the adults themselves, marriage, that commitment, public commitment to each other, is a strengthening factor for that marriage throughout it. You know, both man and, you know, husband and wife can look back and say, I actually promised in public, till death us do part, you know.
Do you think there's a reluctance amongst politicians to talk about family breakdown, and in particular, the benefits that having stable married parents brings to children?
It's a good question. They do ignore it. I think they go according to the polls. And of course, what they're being fed the whole time, and I think there are quite a few activists here pushing the other side, if you like, that we call them progressives. I actually call them regressives. But, you know, for the liberal or expressive liberalism, as it's called, that this is the way that society is developing. And it's been a whole train of thought that you could say come from, you know, philosophers like Rousseau and even Freud and Marx and Nietzsche, and all this sort of slowly developed in the culture and then blossomed in the 60s. So you have this you know, rock and roll sex generation, which is the cool thing, it's the culture thing, you know, the A-list celebrities, you know, you look at Hollywood, you know, you can have multiple marriages, and that's the model we see, multiple relationships. And it's, I think, for a politician to argue against that, they would prefer not to, probably. What they can do is they can still do policies without necessarily, you know, publicizing something. I mean, the policy we've been pushing is the family hub policy, which is actually building on Labour's Sure Start centres. Sure Start centres were, I think, 0 to 5 children, not 0 to 5. You know, being a centre there to help that those early days when there's a lot of stress around in a family. Whereas the family hubs we're pushing, there are fewer of them. But it's 0 to 19 or 0 to 25 for special needs young people. There you've got, fundamentally, it's a hub with spokes coming up, but you've got coming into it government services, the local authority services, the voluntary sector as well. So it's a non-stigmatizing place to go. For instance, say a single mum has a 13-year-old boy and she finds white powder in his pocket, what does she do? You know, does she go to the police? No, I don't think so. Does she go to social services? Probably not. But she could go there and explain and say, I need some help. Can you give some advice? Maybe she'll be guided to a voluntary sector charity, yeah, which deals with that sort of thing. So these are springing up around the country. The government actually is doing it. It's not publicising it very much, which is something I regret. I think they should. But they are establishing family hubs around the country, and some places are very, very enthusiastic, and they're starting to work well and to serve the local community. The idea is to try and prevent family breakdown. So you've got mediation services, maybe working with family courts, which have a huge backlog, often of unnecessary cases, which could be helped by coming to a family hub for mediation, sort of reconciliation services.
Benjamin Disraeli compared the relationship between rich and poor to the inhabitants of different planets, and we're seeing a widening gap between the mainstream society and the most deprived, and particularly this hits areas like the family.
Yeah.
Is poverty a driver for family breakdown?
Well, obviously, it can be. But you can also have parental neglect in very wealthy families, which is quite a factor. You'll find sometimes in the wealthy schools that the teachers will talk about that. You know, that you've got wealthy parents, but they never see the parents, or a chauffeur turns up, or, you know, and I mean, neglect is a big factor, I think, in childhoods, in childhood problems developing. So obviously poverty can be a driver if you've got no money and you've got areas of addiction or domestic violence, etc. That it's easy to walk out, and particularly I think with people who do not know how to handle a problem at home, you can't articulate, you can't argue, so that it can break down, and separation can occur, and the single mum is left with the children.
Right.
However, one should point out that I think that family breakdown is also very high throughout, you know, the social classes, actually, because we live in a culture which is basically encouraging it. There was an article today in CapEx. I can read a little bit. Would you like me to do that?
Please do.
It says, it's by a lady called Sophie Warringer. The roots of the deep hopelessness that seems to be gripping so many of our children goes back further than the lockdown. Family relationships continue to be a top reason young people contact Childline. More than half of children seen by the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services cite family relationship problems as a cause of their mental ill health. Children from dysfunctional families have higher levels of mental disorders than the population. The evidence is that children of married parents tend to have better mental health. ONS, that's the Office of National Statistics, data shows that 6% of those averaged 5 to 10 with married parents had a mental health disorder, compared to 12% with cohabiting parents. Children who live in any other family type except marriage were more likely to display externalizing disorders such as problems with self-control of emotions, which I was just talking about, and behaviors at the age of 5. Critics often say this is due to income levels, but in this study that CapEx made, the gap between children of married and unmarried parents persisted even after an adjustment was made for a range of socio-economic, demographic, and health factors. Okay, so it just underlines that family breakdown, that relational factor, is what is important. And I mean, I'm a Christian, so I do believe in relationships. I mean, at the heart of Christianity is love God and love your neighbor as yourself. So the whole point of existence is to actually be relational to those around you, and in fact, he who is above you. But and if the relationships go wrong, then I think you're in trouble. And I think that's where today's society very much is starting to display signs of, you know, a huge increase in mental illness in young people, in teenagers, which is really jumping up the whole range of people, young people having, you know, ideas of being another gender. You know, well, it wasn't there at all, you know, 40 years ago, and now it's proliferating amongst the teenage population in our schools. All these are signs of a society where relationships have broken down, I think, and the value of committed relationships is not recognized. So there is a, it's almost, I won't say a culture war, but there needs to be a change in the culture. The culture has pushed far too much towards this expressive liberalism, individualism, and the pendulum needs to swing back to where the data shows us that human beings have stable mental health by and large and lead happier lives, children and adults, if they are in stable, committed and good relationships. I mean, I work in the prisons, and I started that. I didn't intend to do it. We just visited the Ministry of Justice and said, what are you doing about strengthening families? And they said, oh, that's very interesting. You should say that, because we've just got this statistic which shows that prisoners who receive family visits are 39% less likely to reoffend than those who don't have them.
Really? That's quite high, yeah.
Oh, it's enormous. And in fact, we've subsequently found out that the statistic for education and employment, which is two other forms of rehabilitation, there was only a reduction of 10% each. And even if you got a prisoner off drugs, that just accounted for 20%. This family visits was double that, yeah. So they asked me to do these two reviews, one for the men's estate and then one for the female estate, how to strengthen prisoners' family relationships in order to reduce recidivism and intergenerational crime. Coming back to the intergenerational crime, if you were a child of a parent who was in prison, you had a 60% chance of going into prison yourself. Yeah, it was huge. The actual reoffending rate at the time we did the review was 43%. So 43% of prisoners were going out of a door and before too long coming back in the door again, all right? But over 60% of children of parents, one parent it only needed to be, who had been in prison were also likely to end up in prison. So it was a huge, again, relational influence. So we did two reviews, one for the male estate and one for the female estate, and the government, I take my hat off to them in this regard. Certainly the Ministry of Justice, that has a captive audience, if you like, sees the value of good relationships. And there's a culture change going on there, I think, throughout their system. So obviously it takes time. But as long as you've got people understanding the benefits and the blessings, if you like, then there will be a movement forward. And I think in the Ministry of Justice, certainly good signs that that's going on. Not so in other departments. There's still the external culture presses in, you know, you know, the individualism, you know, the social media, the whole sexualization of society as well. You know, your identity is defined by your sexuality. Well, a human being is much more than their sexuality.
We recently had prison reformer David Shipley on, and he was saying from his point of view, the big problem is that the voters don't want money to be spent on improving prisons. And could you talk to us a bit about this issue that you call it penal populism?
Yeah. It's interesting. He says voters don't want. I don't think it's been explained to them, frankly. I mean, they might want it if it was explained to them. I'll give you a little. I was interviewed on the Today program a few years back, only for 3 minutes, but after my first review and giving the recommendations for things like video calling, strengthening visits. There's a lot of recommendations which the government's fully implementing, and they were interviewing me, and at the end the last question was, well, Lord Farmer, what do you say to those who say you're being soft on crime? Okay, and I said, well, okay, so if prisoners get family visits, they're 39% less likely to reoffend. So you've got fewer crimes, fewer victims, less police activity, fewer court cases, much less cost to society. You haven't got so many people locked up to begin with, which is, what, £47,000 a year or something. Fewer people coming back into prison. I said, I don't call that soft on crime, I call that hard on crime. And that argument needs to be given over. Now, I mean, I gave this talk on penal populism versus liberal optimism. And the problem is that what you said is the sort of prevailing understanding in the media and with the political parties. So there's a sort of competition, particularly in the last year before an election, as who can be quote-unquote hardest on crime, which in their language means, what are we seeing today, extending prison sentences. This whole emphasis on the victim and it is sort of encouraging vigilantism, if you like, amongst the population. You know, lock them up and throw the key away. Be as hard as you can be. That's all they deserve. Whereas actually, I mean, we have a prisoners and victims and prisoners bill going through the Houses of Parliament at the moment, and it's interesting. It's called Victims and Prisoners, and the main emphasis is on the victims. Right. And the main emphasis is on what can one do about the victims, rather than seeing that possibly the prisoners themselves, many of the prisoners, have earlier been victims themselves. Whereas we look at the female estate very much with those glasses on. So you have in the female estate just under 4,000 prisoners in prison. In the male estate, you've got well over 80,000. Now, that's a huge difference. Why? Because we look at one as being, they're the victims of domestic violence, the abuse, sexual predators, etc. Whereas males are seen as the abusers, the predators, and to be locked up and throwing the key away. So penal populism is very simple and unthought through policy, particularly coming up to an election. And it's all competition between the parties as to who can be hardest on crime. Yes, we're really going to be hard. This is how they define it. It's not being hard on crime, but it doesn't reduce crime, actually. We're seeing crime going up. Liberal optimism, on the other side, which is what I, is where actually you do see everyone as a victim, and therefore the whole punishment area of what we all know is a moral decision. I mean, if I'm going to lie to you, I've got to know the truth in here and turn it upside down and then tell you something else. So I know what I'm doing. If I'm going to steal from you, I know you've got something I want. I'm not going to tell you about it. I'm going to take it and hope nobody. You know, there is natural morality throughout humanity, actually. If you kill somebody, you know how precious your own life is. You're taking that precious life away from somebody else. So crime does deserve punishment, but the punishment is a deprivation of liberty. So it is the prison sentence. But then the government has the duty of care and the duty to rehabilitate while the person is in prison. Furthering the punishment by conditions in prison is not prescribed by the courts. It's a deprivation of liberty. So there is a duty of rehabilitation, and the recognition here, as I say, of relationships, of backgrounds, you know, 25% coming from the care system, all these factors are clearly showing that the way to do it is to encourage good relationships. So you've got a middle way between the penal populism and the liberal optimism, which at the moment is what we're pushing for in the prisons.
We recently saw judges told to try not to put people in prison because of the overcrowding. I mean, how do we get to this point where there's so many, mainly men, as you pointed out, in prison, and what can we safely do about it?
Well, I think we've got there, but because of penal populism, and particularly for the male estate, as we can see. I mean, there are fundamental, just natural answers as well. The population of the United Kingdom, I mean, how many years, 20 years ago, it was 56 million. It's now 68 million. It's supposed to grow more. You've got a huge increase in population. You know, you've had a lot of immigrant, sort of gangs, the Albanians, and they say that there aren't enough prisons, so we're building the prisons as well. But to build a big prison costs, I don't know, it's about hundreds of millions of pounds. So it does take time to increase the prison capacity. You've also got the whole area of things like IPP. You've got remand prisoners there as well. If you go to a reception prison, I mean, some remand prisoners, have been in prison for over a year, and this can make up 10% of the population at times, where the courts are just clogged. It comes back to also that cultural look at men and women, which is something I am arguing about in the all-party parliamentary group for men and boys. We do have a great emphasis on women and girls, and we've got a minister for women and girls, but we don't have one for men and boys. And yet, you know, men and boys in many areas are the ones falling behind, particularly in sort of poorer areas of our country.
What role do you think society's attitude towards men in general plays in all of this?
Well, I think, as I say, society's attitude is actually quite important. It's how the media present it. I think men, the whole area of men's suicide is greater than females. men don't speak about. Men have a problem with articulating their problems, and it's also that that ancient sort of stoicism of the male, that you don't admit that you're weak, and you don't admit that you're sad, and so you don't talk to anybody. Rural suicide is quite high amongst all the rural community, farming communities, because there's a lot of loneliness. But the whole coming back to the breakdown of families, you know, it's the male that leaves, all right, and is often excluded by the courts. So who do you see in the streets, on the homeless? I mean, it's far more prevalent to be males. I think society just accepts that. And we haven't heard the countervailing argument of the needs of the male, which are relational. And to understand, if you like, the different qualities of male and females, they aren't all the same. I mean, females have a far more relational awareness than males. I mean, males are sort of straightforward, it's a job to do, and you know, and to be able to articulate one's feelings is more difficult, I think, for a male. So I think we have a very big problem in Western society as a whole, but particularly in Britain, because we seem to be the sort of leader in the sort of individualism. I mean, which has been encouraged by both governments. We last 30, 40 years, I mean, really since the 60s, actually. And you've had criminality going up since the 60s. You know, there was what I've talked about is the U-curve of deviance, which was in a book talking about how in the 1850s to 1900s, there is data that showed that criminality decreased. All right, there was quite a significant decrease in criminality. One of the factors was that the average age of prisoners went up. In other words, you weren't getting young people going in there so much. There weren't, so the average age of prisoners went up, right. And they actually they were looking at how could this be, and one of the areas that they decided was a great influence on this was, funnily enough, Victorian Sunday schools. Yeah. All right, so there was morality being taught there. It was then at the 1900s when this whole area of seeing people as victims, seeing criminals as victims, came in as what causalism as opposed to moralism. And so criminality went down, then it flattened out for the first half of the 20th century, both world wars. And it was in the late 50s, 60s, rock and roll and sex, etc., where it went like that. And that's coming back to your earlier question. It is also one of the reasons for the rise in the prisons being fuller, because you've just got this lack of moral guidance, lack of knowing what's right and wrong, very much a looking after oneself. And the actual U-curve, it went like that, and it's still going like that. So you have got criminality abounding.
I think it's kind of become unfashionable to accept that there is a right and a wrong, and the promotion of the self and individualism is much higher than having some kind of moral code now.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what I've been trying to say, in a way. I mean, it's come... I think it's Sigmund Freud who said that, we are defined by our sexual identity. One can go back to him and blame him. But frankly, it's, as I said, the human being is far more than that. And I mean, as a Christian, you've got the whole area of where you're being told, if you like, but by the creator, what is right and wrong. And I think actually what I find as a Christian, that the sort of Ten Commandments and the whole morality of Christianity works. It works. So if you have a faithful marriage and you bring up children, well, you know what? You're likely to be happier. The children are likely to do better. They progress. They have less mental illness and everything else. Is what I was talking about earlier. I've been a Christian for 40 years or so, or longer. And I was thinking, bringing up my own children, I thought it was almost unfair. I had an unfair advantage because I know what's right and wrong and what's good and bad. And I can try and walk that path, and there are benefits. And those who don't know that. And so you go all over the place, particularly with the media. I mean, you've had a lot of media. I mean, we had No-Fault Divorce coming through to begin with, which really, No-Fault Divorce, where it's, you make a promise for life to be faithful, good times, bad times, rich, poor, illness, sickness, health, and then no fault, when somebody's gone off and, with another woman or whoever, there is breaking covenant promises. And so it's, as I say, the advantages and blessings are very clear. It works. And that's what I say. And the politicians and the media, of course, you look at the serious media pushing, it's extraordinary. You look at Times and the Telegraph recently, they've been pushing group sex and all sorts of other things, and the Tinder type relationships. Well, that's popular liberalism, actually. It's a here and now and the self-gratification, but actually it augurs very badly for the future and the way one looks at a society that actually is embracing those values. It's a society in decline, I think. You're losing its stabilizing foundations, the foundations that you've got of very flighty relationships, are very feeble foundations, can be knocked away very quickly. Therefore, you have the mental illnesses, you have the loneliness, you have the suicides, self-harm, drug addiction.
So you talked a bit about the move towards liberalism. And one issue that I thought is particularly damaging and that doesn't get the attention it deserves is pornography. I wonder if you could talk something about the damage you feel that's doing to society.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I couldn't understand it. We had all these laws which said pornography was illegal. And then all of a sudden, when the internet comes along, it's available at the push of a couple of buttons. The most graphic, the most extreme, to anybody in the world. And we've suddenly got the human race which has never experienced this experience before in its history, where you are able to view graphic sexual activity of all sorts. And yet we don't ask ourselves, is this doing any harm? We don't ask ourselves, whoops, this was illegal. How come everybody's watching it and we're not doing anything about it? And in fact, one of the things I raised, I think when I first came into Parliament, that I was accused sometimes when I stood up and said something that I hadn't done the research. And I thought to myself, well, surely if the government has laws against pornography And all of a sudden, there is this new system of delivering pornography instead of magazines and on the television. You've just got it through your mobile phone or anywhere else, on your iPad. Then, you know, how do we, you know, how come that's happened without any change in the law? We need to stop that happening, do the research, find out is this good or bad, and then make laws accordingly. It's still illegal, but we never did that. And there was this Silicon Valley, sort of Californian liberalism, which spread over that said, this, the golden rule of the internet is that it's free, and it's free of censorship. So anything on it, and this is the golden great rule. Well, of course, it's a pernicious rule because it allows all sorts of evil to actually spread through it, and which is what we're seeing today. So it's taken 20 years, 30 years for governments to slowly wake up, slowly become aware. Yep, pornography is not a good thing.
Pornography. At the time, we've also seen children being given devices that
absolutely
can access this.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you talk to any parent, the time they scared stiff is when they go to secondary school. But even in primary schools, you've got the mobile phones and, have you seen this? Have you seen this? You know, what's, you know, I mean, in our generation, my generation, I mean, obviously, you grow up and you have, you know, the hormonal changes and the, you know, teenage puberty and, you know, there's great, you know, sex awakening, if you like. But to have that connected with what you see now, why do you have so many girls at school wanting to be boys? I think it's one of the main reasons is because they've seen what boys can do to girls in pornography. So to protect themselves, they become a boy. But actually, when you become an adult, why do you get so many men wanting to be a woman? Well, actually, the law states voyeurism and exposing yourself are criminals. And in fact, you go on the sex register if you do it. But actually, if you say you're a woman, wear a wig, you can go into women's changing rooms and be as voyeuristic as you like, in fact. And if somebody accuses you of that, they'll be the one who will be warned. And even you can expose yourself the whole time. I mean, and this is what you hear in hospital wards, and it's even happened in prisons. But thankfully, I think the prisons have now settled down. And that's what's happening. I think people, funny enough, the MOJ, coming back to that, the prison system is often the place where it starts, because you see the hard results of these things. So, right, let's stop putting trans women, intact male trans women, into female prisons. Let's keep them, maybe have a certain block in a certain prison which is for trans women. Just as to that, you know. But don't put them in with you know, females. And I mean, it's exposing, obviously, the female prisoners to risk, and it's just making them live in an unsafe place.
Do you feel positive things are happening? We're moving in the right direction.
I think the pendulum's starting to swing back. I mean, it's common sense, isn't it? I mean, thinking about common sense, it ain't so common, but. I think the whole ridiculousness of a man being able to say I'm a woman and take on, if you like, the rights of being a woman. It's the evidence is coming out that biological male female is the fundamental truth, and I mean, it's not to say you. I'm not saying stop people you know, saying they're a woman, but you can't have female rights going into their safe spaces, if you like. So there's no doubt about it. I think there is a move back, but it does come back again to relationships and these committed relationships. And you know, one needs to be aware, I think, that if one's life is identified by one's sexuality, and you know, as we mentioned, pornography, which encourages promiscuity, you know, you've got the accompanying physical diseases you can get from it. You've got the mental diseases. You've got the relational breakdowns, etc. The stats are there, and that it doesn't lead to a happy life. And one needs politicians and governments to actually work for the common good for the longer term. The problem is that we have 5-year electoral cycles, and that's where it comes back to penal populism. You don't have enough politicians with courage who actually are almost prepared to sacrifice their own career for the common good.
Lord Farmer, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.